I'm very glad to be here to be able to give this talk. And the title of my talk is Moduli Stabilization and Holographic RG in NT-the Sitter Space and the Sitter Space. This is based on mostly on my recent paper with Eva Silverstein, Gonzalo Toroba, and Bart Horn at Stanford. And this is one of those talks where I can actually start by asking a very simple question. And at the end, I will actually give a very concrete answer. So let me just start with the question, and then I'll explain it along the way, and eventually try to give a concrete result. So the question is very simple. Basically, if you have some Lorentzian field theory that is supposed to be holographically dual to the Sitter space, what properties must it have in order for that to happen? So this is a question that is motivated by understanding the Sitter space, of course. So before answering it, let me first give some motivation of why we should be interested in the question. A lot of progress has been made in understanding quantum gravity. In particular, we have the holographic principle, which is the general statement that a gravitational system can be captured by a theory living in lower dimensions. And a crude analogy would be this picture. We also have the entropy law, which says it's the entropy is given in terms of the horizon surface area in Planck unit divided by 4. And a picture of that is given by thinking about the horizon of the black hole as 1 bit per Planck area. Although, just as an aside, based on recent argument by Joe Pochinski and collaborators, maybe I should have replaced it by a firewall or something like that. But that's not going to be the talk. We also have ADS-CFT, which provides a complete description of quantum gravity from the CFT side, provides a complete description for ADS space. And this is a very remarkable tool in understanding quantum gravity in this negatively curved space-time. However, that's not the place we live in, and we still don't have the same level of understanding about our universe as compared to NT-the Sitter space, because at present we don't really have a complete theoretical framework for understanding cosmology in a quantum gravity setting. And that includes either the Sitter space or general expanding FRW universes. An immediate question is, since we learned so much from ADS-CFT already about quantum gravity, can we use them to understand cosmology in perhaps some holographic way? So this is something that Eva and I and collaborators at Stanford have been thinking in the past few years, mostly trying to develop a holographic framework for understanding cosmology. Before we try to do that, let me just give a list of difficulties that we encounter generally when we try to do this. Unlike ADS-CFT, we have a list of features that is difficult to straightforwardly generalize from ADS-CFT to cosmology. In particular, we don't have a non-fluctuating time-life boundary in cosmology, or such as the Sitter space. We don't have supersymmetry. We usually have dynamical gravity in the dual theory, so the dual theory is not really a field theory, but some matter sector coupled to gravity. We normally have...
I'm confused by this. Is this that in the usual examples, in the CFT, you have gravity?
Are you talking about FRW-CFT and DS-CFT? They both eventually involve an integration of the metric at the end. So it is really a CFT coupled to gravity. In other words, think about DICFT. If you want to calculate a bulk quantity, for example, a bulk correlation function, you have to integrate over all possible metric fluctuations at a future boundary. So a physical observable actually involves the lower dimensional gravity. And this has come up a lot in recent discussions about DICFT. So does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Do we understand that well enough to know that it's something like Einstein gravity, or is it just it's a theory of a conformal field theory and something with geometry?
I don't think we have a definite answer. But one of the things I'm going to say later is if we are actually in low enough dimensions, like if the boundary has two dimensions, then it may be some form of Liouville gravity where we may hope to control. So holographically, that at least will describe some three-dimensional bulk space-time.
Or if it was in three-dimensional boundary, and it was like Einstein gravity, that would just be a topological gravity. So
It has a large matter sector, so the gravity
the gravity degrees of freedom themselves won't contribute anything locally, so maybe that's not a big difference. Just having matter.
One answer to your question is the examples we have. At least from string theory, are all compactified examples down to three dimensions. So instead of being actual three-dimensional examples, they are three dimensions, three non-compact dimensions times, for example, a three-sphere times a four-torus. And therefore, it's actually a 10-dimensional theory. It's just like ADS5 cross S5, which is dual to a four-dimensional CFT.
It's a string theory.
Yeah.
If you were just doing
I'm going to talk about how eventually we want to think about all this in the string theory setting, not just in terms of pure gravity in three dimensions. As a complete list, we also have horizons, and we need to understand entropies associated to the horizons, singularities in cosmology, how are they consistent with unitarity of the theory. The pseudo space usually decay, at least all the string theory solutions do decay non-perturbatively, and cosmology is almost by definition time dependent in some sense. So this is a set of difficulties, but we can still understand, keeping this in mind, we can still try to generalize ADS-CFT to a cosmological setting, and I found the most direct generalization to be what is known as the DSDS correspondence, which is what I'm going to talk about now. It is going to be the framework where I'm going to ask the question, what is the property of the dual theory for the pseudo space? So let me give a basic review of what the correspondence says. It was first proposed by four people, like Alicia Ia, Karch, Eva Silverstein, and David Tong in 2004. It is basically comes from an observation that we can foliate higher dimensional de Sitter space in terms of a lower dimensional de Sitter space with a varying warp factor, which is simply a sine function. So on the Penrose diagram, the region covered by this coordinate looks like the square. And note that the warp factor has two zeros. One is at w equals zero, which can be thought of as a horizon, past and future horizon here. And also at w equals pi times rds, where rds is the curvature radius of both the Sitter space. So the other horizon is here. And the warp factor also has a finite maximum, which is at the central slice which is W equals pi over 2 times R. I have drawn a few constant W surfaces. And one can think about this metric as describing two throats that are joined smoothly in the ultraviolet. One way to think about this is each half of the square describes some low energy effective is described by some d-dimensional effective field theory dual, just as in usual ADS CFT with a Planck brain cutoff, where the UV Planck brain can be thought of as the U central slice. And as is the case in ADS CFT with a Planck brain, we have the effective field theory has a finite UV cutoff because the warp factor does not go to infinity, but stays at 1 in the UV. And also that the two effective field theories are coupled to gravity and also to each other, talking through the UV slice. So in short, in one sentence, the correspondence gives quantum gravity in d plus one dimensional De Sitter space in terms of a dual theory living on lower dimensional De Sitter space, which has an IR sector whose IR sector is basically a product of two effective field theories, but in the UV they join together. So that's the basic picture. It's very analogous to Randall Sundrum model or warped compactification. And in fact, since they are so related to each other, we can actually come up with a brain construction that realizes this DSDS correspondence. And I'm going to just give a very quick review of what that is. It's not completely essential to the talk I'm going to give today, but it's nice to have these examples, specific examples in mind when we talk about general features of the dual theory. So the way we construct a brain construction that realizes the correspondence is basically by putting D1, D5 brains, which are color brains, at tips of at the two tips of a compact cone. The cone is being supported by a bunch of flavor brains and orientifolds. There's a list of ingredients, and it's not terribly enlightening to go through all of them, except that if you can check that they support, they give the solution of this kind. That if we take the near horizon limit, it gives basically the two warp throats that we have in the DSDS correspondence. And a useful thing that came out of this procedure is that we can actually give counting of the Gibbons-Hawking entropy that is associated to the De Sitter horizon in terms of microstates that the brain system has. Basically, the color brains and flavor brains support a bunch of microstates, and they account for, at least parametrically, the entropy of the De Sitter space. So that's a very quick review of the DSDS correspondence. I'm going to, just to avoid confusion, I'm going to point out the difference between DSDS correspondence and another proposal for DS holography, which is known as DSCFT. They are very different on the face of it. A DSDS correspondence is manifestly Lorentzian. The field theory is defined on a Lorentzian manifold, which is a lower dimensional De Sitter space, and it's also unitary. The DSCFT has a CFT description on the future boundary of the De Sitter space, and is Euclidean, manifestly non-unitary. That doesn't mean the bulk is not unitary. So there has to be some non-trivial condition for bulk unitarity coming from a non-unitary CFT. So that's sort of the question for DSCFT. For DSDS, it covers the static patch. therefore is accessible to a single observer. DSCFT contains the entire future boundary of global de Sitter, so it actually contains observables that are out of causal contact from each other from the bulk space-time point of view. However, at last we come to one advantage of DSCFT, which is that it preserves the symmetry of global de Sitter space in a very explicit form through the conformal invariance of the CFT, whereas DSCS correspondence doesn't really have that much symmetry preserved in a manifest way. This is because the static patch, for example, doesn't have all the symmetries of global de Sitter space. It is entirely possible that these two ways of approaching...
So it's not just a CFT on a different space.
It's not a CFT. Yeah, that's right. It's not on a... It is some other field theory. This is precisely what I'm asking and going to answer by the end of the talk, which is since it's not conformal invariance, the field theory is not conformal invariant, but it still has some property that is analogous to conformal invariance that allows us to recover the symmetries of the Sitter space. In particular, you can think about the question in this way. From the bulk point of view, the Sitter space is just as special as ADS space. They both have very maximal symmetry. In the ADS case, if it's described by a theory which is conformally invariant, then in the DS case, we expect from this DSDS correspondence something just as constraining as conformal invariance in the dual theory. Yes?
To make sense of this field theory coupled to gravity, you would go down dimension until you get to dimension two?
That's one perspective.
What is another?
Another perspective is you can, well, by D, so by D, another perspective is there are things you can do which is independent of counting of, which is, so if you want a complete description, yes, that's what you have to do what you said, I think, from this perspective.
How would you explain that?
If you only need, for some purposes, you actually don't need to know how the theory itself is coupled to gravity. So consider a field theory that is coupled to gravity at some high scale. You already, even though it's coupled to gravity and we don't understand how exactly this can be defined, we still know there are degrees of freedom that is associated with just the field theory part of the sector, the field theory sector of the theory. And what that tells us is a part of a subset of, you can think of it as a subset of degrees of freedom in the theory. And in particular, this was very useful in parametrically counting the entropy. It turns out those subset of degrees of freedom is an order one percentage of all degrees of freedom that should be there in this theory based on a comparison of that counting and the Sitter entropy.
But what if I want to make sense of both at the same time? I want the theory to be well defined, so I go all the way down to two dimension. And I want to account for the entropy that go like now, let's say you're starting from four dimension, like a three-dimensional volume. And now something that is the number of degrees of freedom of a local theory in three dimension is now described by two dimensions.
Are you asking how the entropy works if you have
our two-dimensional theory manage to capture the entropy that scale like a three-dimensional volume?
Because they have different. So let me tell you how to answer this question. If I keep D general, if I have a D plus one-dimensional theory and it's supposedly to be dual to a D-dimensional theory, the entropy is actually the same. the Planck, if you can work out the relation between the Planck mass between these two theories, they're not equal, and they account for exactly what. So in other words, the surface area in the higher dimensional theory, in the higher dimensional Planck unit, is the same as the same quantity in the lower dimensional theory. I can explain it to you in more details after the talk if you're interested.
Since Amit slowed you down, where did the static patch come from? I didn't see that at all. Is that a brain thing or?
This is something from the DSDS course, just from the macroscopic picture. This is something.
Right, but if we go back, yes. I mean, you just have a de Sitter metric there.
Right, right.
The biennial de Sitter metric.
It could be non-static patch, but the point is, it could also be static patch. So it's possible. So this is non-trivial to check, I guess. It is possible to slice precisely the static patch of a higher dimensional de Sitter space in terms of a lower dimensional de Sitter space.
Oh, you're saying that patch that's covered by this chart, that is precisely the static patch.
On the Perron's diagram, I have to draw it very carefully because each point on the Perron's diagram corresponds to a d minus two dimensional sphere.
Right.
So I'm saying as a if you could write down an explicit coordinate system for the static patch of d-dimensional and d plus one-dimensional de Sitter space, and you'll see that if you can exactly foliate the static patch by static patches. That's not true, for example, for global de Sitter. If you try to use global de Sitter here, you get something a little bit less than global de Sitter, meaning this part, yeah. But the static patch story is really nice in the sense that you can just go down. And there's nothing extra you get. And it fits very, very nicely. So in some sense, it is something we choose. We choose to talk about the static patch, slice by the static patch. But I think it's also physically motivated in a sense that it contains all the observables that is accessible to one observer. So that is a conservative description of a Hilbert space.
So do you mean in that formula on the right hand side where it says that's also the static patch?
Yes, yes.
Not the whole
yes.
Sitter.
One can take both sides as the Sitter static patch. Basically you can think about this as first writing down a higher dimensional sphere, slice it by higher dimensional sphere. You use the spherical coordinates, which is a bunch of theta and one phi at the end. You analytically continue that phi, and you get this.
You're trying to be more precise.
Yeah.
Suppose you put black hole in this bagel and try to describe the entropy of this black hole, not of the Sitter itself.
It's a very good question.
Okay. Yeah. But it has some entropy and some mass. And there is a relation between the entropy and the mass, and this relation depends on the dimension you start with, and it's not the one of the two-dimensional.
The putting a black hole in the center of the static patch, I assume that's what you're talking.
Well, that's a wave from your.
You can always use, as long as it's inside a static patch, you can always use. It has some interesting features in terms of what it looks like from the field theory point of view. But just let me mention that there is one result, which is from the field theory point of view, it looks also like a black hole, but it is a black hole that is supported by a stress tensor which has trace zero. So this is a bizarre black hole in some sense.
Okay, we can continue later. Let me put two, then you cannot.
Yeah, things get more complicated when you try to put more than one in them. Let's talk about this later, because it's a complicated story. It also destroys the nice slicing that already have if you put two.
Can I ask you yet another question? If we go back. You made an analogy to Randall syndrome.
Yes.
Joining two throats.
Yes.
So in that perspective, I think the joining is at W equals pi by 2.
The joining is pi
right
over
there.
Two.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the curvature scale of that De Sitter space is the same. It's basically R.
Basically.
But doesn't that same scale also play the role of the cutoff?
Yes. It's like thinking
so I have an effective field theory on a geometry that
it is basically the problem. It has the same yes. It is like thinking about ADS CFT with in the region which is of order R ADS. It is the same. It has exactly the same confusion that we have regarding that case. So
no, but in ADS in ADS CFT. Well, if I do Randall-Sunderman ADS,
yes.
I can make the geometry arbitrarily flat. The curvature can be zero, and the cutoff is whatever the cutoff scale is. Here, it seems we have the geometry being the same order as.
I understand. I was thinking about the global picture of ADS CFT. One can also it's more like this because then
sure.
The space has curvature.
Yeah.
And one can also think about the Randall-Sundrum model in terms of in that setting. And one can try to put the UV brain so far into the interior so that it also only contains a one R ADS size.
Right.
And that would be exactly that's what I mean. That's exactly the same thing as we have here. So I agree.
Usually I wouldn't do that because I think that's a really confusing place.
Yeah, but we do believe the duality even there, right? So I agree that we don't have we don't understand even in the case of ADS CFT the bulk locality within one R ADS size very well in order to answer both that question and the same question that you are posing here. So I agree it's a very important question eventually to be addressed. I'm just pointing out the same question also exists for ADS.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. It's not a complete answer. Okay. And yeah, basically, we want to find, in the case of DS-DS correspondence, what is the manifestation of the DS symmetry in the dual theory. And as I emphasized earlier, it's not conformal invariance, but it should be something that is just as constraining as conformal invariance. And we will see in terms of explicitly what that means. In order to see that, we need to take a slightly different perspective on the question. And let's take a step back and think about ADS CFT for a while. There we have the full ADS symmetry. Usually, the way we proceed in proposing a duality is the asymptotic symmetry group of ADS is the same as the conformal group. So we expect there is some conformal field theory living on the boundary. So it's basically a symmetry argument that tells us what the field theory should behave if we have ADS symmetry. But since we don't have the same logic here in the De Sitter case, we want to find another way from ADS symmetry to conformal invariance. And that is provided by the triangle here. Here, what I'm trying to say is there is a relation from the Bach point of view that ADS CFT can be reformulated by saying at least ADS symmetry implies that all the scalar fields and other fields respect the ADS symmetry. In particular, if we think about ADS bulk in simple terms, like a bunch of scalar fields in some potential, then all those scalar fields need to be sitting at some extremum of that potential. That is related to the ADS symmetry by the bulk equations. And I'm going to, as I will show later, this is related to the conformal invariance of the CFT through a procedure known as a holographic RG. So by using the bulk equations, which is completely a bulk idea, and holographic RT to translate that bulk idea into a field theory idea, we can find an alternative way of explaining the conformal invariance of the CFT in the ADS CFT case.
Can you explain this better just from ADS CFT perspective? You're not trying to say that everything is stabilized, right? For example, dilaton is not stabilized.
I'm sorry, I should have explained it just 30 seconds ago. Here by stabilized, I mean a mode is stabilized in ADS as long as its mass squared is above the BF bound.
But I'm sorry, I still don't understand what stabilization means. So I agree that if it is a massive one, right? For example, if I were to ask the question, suppose I had a radius of S5,
yes,
and write down an effective field theory for that mode, then that is a massive mode, so it will stabilize, it will sit at the minimum potential.
Yes.
However, a dilaton or any marginal operator will get reflected.
I agree, and it can be even top of the hill, which is a maximum of the potential. That's why I said, as long as its mass squared is
right
above the BF bound, I call it stable. It's stable in the sense that from the bulk point of view, the gradient energy in as you approach the asymptotic boundary balances against the negative mass squared as long as it is above the BF.
I understand that, but it's just you're presenting a new way of thinking about holographic RG flow and ADS CFT, and I don't.
I'm totally happy to replace these two words by V prime equals zero at the location where the scalar field is sitting at in the bulk. That's the extremum is actually.
That's exactly my question. So
yes.
And then are you assuming that V prime equals to zero gives you a unique solution?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, so not a unique solution. They can be. For example, even in ADS 5 cross S5, there is a flat direction corresponding to
right.
N equals the flat marginal deformation
exactly.
of N equals 4.
Right.
But you have to choose one instance. You have to, for each ADS CFT pair in that case, you have to choose one coupling.
So in your case, modular stabilization is nothing but the bulk equation, is it?
Let me just replace that by saying that the solution in the bulk has the feature that the scalar fields are sitting at an extremum of the potential,
but that's
which
the
could
same
total...
to say that they solve bulk equations of motion. So I don't.
I totally agree.
So that's not any new principle.
It's not a new principle at all. It's just another way of thinking about why we have ADS space, ADS symmetry in the bulk. And it is a reformulation of that in a sense that it allows us, it is most intimately related to conformal invariance. I'll explain later.
But if I take an RG flow which is driven by a marginal, by relevant operator, I still have what you call this modular stabilization principle, which I would call just on shell bulk equations of motion. But that doesn't mean that I have conformal invariance.
No, I think in that case, what happens if you turn on a relevant perturbation, then the bulk field is actually rolling in the R direction from, for example, a maximum to a minimum. In that case, it is not true that V prime is zero everywhere in the bulk. Let me replace the box here by saying V prime equals zero everywhere in the box, which is, as you say, just the equation of just another way of saying the equation of motion.
Maybe I'm confused.
Don't you mean equation of motion plus ADS symmetry? It's not. In that arrow, you're ignoring the ADS.
Yeah, I think you're complaining from going here to here. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, but from here to here, it does imply V prime equals zero.
Right, but you're still keeping the symmetry requirement. It's not just any solution of the equation.
You're just assuming there's some vacuum with the maximal set of symmetries.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
Yes, basically, yeah. We'll see how precisely what this means in the next part of the talk. What I'm trying to do, basic idea is try to find another way of formulating the question that can also lead us to conformal invariance. And I will claim that that route is can be straightforwardly generalized to the De Sitter case, and that's why we're interested. So that may answer, that can lead to an answer what the question mark is. So yeah, let me now talk about how exactly these two are related through the holographic RG framework. This is a framework of holographic Wilsonian RG, which was proposed in a paper by Itzhak Himskirk and Joe Polchinski in 2010 for the case of ADS-CFT in flat slicing. And it is a very straightforward exercise to just generalize that to, for example, from ADS to DS or from flat slicing to curved slicing. So let's basically review how that works. We have about, I'm keeping the bulk geometry very general in a sense that it is can be any geometry where I have a foliation in terms of a lower dimensional slice. And this A is the warp factor. Y is the proper coordinate in the radial direction. It's the same as the W that I had earlier for the DSDS case. And the bulk geometry basically looks like something like this. There's an IR region, and there's a UV region. And we think about the bulk spacetime as having a cutoff at some coordinate YUV. In the ADS case, we usually impose a cutoff. In the DS case, it comes naturally with a cutoff at the central slice, so that's what we usually use. And let's choose some intermediate slice denoted by the green dashed line so that we divide the space into two parts, and we can perform the partition function, can perform the path integral in the partition function in basically two steps. And that's very analogous to what we do in a QFT. Remember that we can, through the ADS-CFT dictionary, we can identify the radius y in the bulk with some scale, energy scale in the quantum field theory, which is basically given by the warp factor. So quantum field theory scale is given by the proper energy in the bulk for localized excitation times the warp factor A. And so we can turn this picture around and think about the same thing that we do in the quantum field theory, where we have a cutoff at some high scale. We have basically the IR sector at zero energy. And we can integrate down and to some intermediate scale and get an effective action for the low energy modes. It is interesting that the holographic scheme, in some sense, is not completely sharp from the field theory point of view. This, for example, is manifest from thinking about different kinds of modes in the bulk. Supergravity modes has proper energy of order 1 over r, r being the curvature scale. And string modes usually have a much higher energy than the supergravity modes. And they come with different cutoff in the field theory language. If we impose a uniform cutoff at the given y. And also, it is not sharp in the sense that a localized mode is smeared out in the bulk. So when you cut it off using a surface, you have to the resulting thing in the field theory is not completely sharp, but somehow fuzzy. But it turns out, as we learn from ADS-CFT, that this might be a good way of thinking about the RG structure. And in fact, as I will show later, this particular RG scheme, which is basically inspired by holography, actually simplifies the RG structure in an important way. But let me first say how we actually do this. We take the same bulk spacetime, and then we can write down the bulk partition function as a path integral over a set of fields in the bulk, which are collectively called phi. And I'm using the Euclidean formulation. So S is the Euclidean action of all the fields in the bulk. It is different from the usual action by because I pulled out the factor of 1 over kappa squared. Kappa squared is basically the Newton's constant in the bulk. The reason for doing this is it makes all the large n counting that I'm going to do much simpler, because kappa, 1 over kappa is basically like n in the dual theory. So I'm going to split the partition function into two regions, y greater than L and y smaller than L, and I call them psi uv and psi L. And they depend on the field configuration on this green slice, which is phi tilde. So eventually I'll integrate over phi tilde in the last step. And as I mentioned earlier, in the quantum field theory, we can integrate out UV modes, and that leads to effective action. So we expect intuitively that psi UV should contain some information about that. It's not exactly the effective action yet, because currently, right now, it's expressed in terms of this bulk field, phi tilde, and not yet expressed in terms of quantum field theory variables. So there's one more step to take, which is we can write psi IR in terms of using the standard ADS-CFT dictionary. We can write psi IR in terms of a path integral of a field theory with a cutoff. So M here is some matrix field in the large N gauge theory that is supposed to be dual to this. And it comes with a cutoff that depends on the L that I have imposed. And through the usual ADS-CFT dictionary, it says that I should couple the source of I should couple the boundary condition for the bulk field to the dual operator in the quantum field theory. So here I have called the operator O to be the one which is dual to phi in the bulk. It is a single trace operator in the sense that generically can be thought of as a trace of products of derivatives of the matrix field. And SQFT is just a bare action. So using this, we can immediately find what the effective action is by doing this RG. What we do is to plug the psi IR into here, and then the entire partition function can therefore be written as a path integral over the low energy modes. And then, since it is only a path integral over the low energy modes, the resulting action that we get is the Wilsonian action in some sense. And this Wilsonian action, which I have called little s, is just everything that is left in this formula. So we have a d phi tilde, we have psi uv, and we have this coupling between phi tilde and O from ADS-CFT. So looking at this formula, it says something very simple. It says what we should have for the effective action as a function of the operator O should be an integral transform of psi uv as a function of the bulk field phi tilde. So that's a very simple thing to do. And finally, we, in order to extract the RG running from this effective action, we can expand the effective action in terms of all the operators in the field theory. And in particular, if we only have, say, one scalar field, and if we only consider one single trace operator O, we can Taylor expand in terms of powers of O. And the coefficients here, sigma n, is basically the dimensionless couplings of the QFT. They generally depend on the scale. So the derivative of sigma n with respect to L gives the beta function, for example. For CFT on flat space, we know conformal invariance says they are all independent of L. So that's the sort of things we recover in the ADS case. So now we can actually state our results. Our results is if we have a bulk theory which involves phi sitting at extremum phi star, which I call phi star, of some bulk potential, then there is a set of conditions on what the effective action should behave, in particular the single trace coupling, which is the coefficient of O, must be independent of L. And it is, in fact, given just by minus the location of the extremum in the bulk potential. That means the single trace couplings are all zero in this case. And we also have that the multi-trace couplings, sigma n, generally do depend on L. So this is different from the case where we have ADS CFT in flat slicing. But their beta functions, although their beta functions are not zero, their beta functions are only functions of lower trace couplings. So their beta functions are independent of all the higher trace ones. This is known as an iterative structure of the RG flow. It's a non-trivial simplification of the RG, because normally in field theory, let's take your favorite phi to the fourth example maybe. We know that if we do it in a Wilsonian way, the running of any given operator in this theory, consistent with the symmetry of this theory, receives contribution from both lower dimensional and higher dimensional operators. In a large N theory, we also generally expect that a given coupling receives contribution from both lower trace and higher trace ones. However, only in this case where phi is sitting at some minimum of the potential, through this holographic RG framework, we find that they have this interesting simplified structure. Let me just say it in more concrete form. If we follow the procedure that I outlined earlier, starting with a bulk action, which is basically the kinetic term for phi, and a potential term, now we can actually solve the running of all these couplings in terms of the bulk potential. And what happens, so this looks complicated, but the left-hand side is always the beta function, basically the running of these couplings, and the right-hand side is a contribution from different terms. And we note that for the second equation governing sigma 1, if we put sigma 1 to be at minus the extremum of the potential, this gets immediately solved. So that's the part where we say the single trace operator has a zero beta function. And once we have v prime equals zero, and also sigma 1 is sitting at the extremum, all these terms that involve basically sigma n plus 1 in this general equation drops out. And it turns out the beta function only involves basically sigma for lower sigma 2 through sigma n, and not involve sigma n plus 1 and so on. This is the iterative structure in a basic concrete form. And it just follows from this holographic RG formalism. And just as a very first check of that we're on the right path, we see this set of equation is very general. It holds not only for ADS, the Sitter slicing, but or DS slicing, but also just for flat slicing of ADS CFT, which we well understand. So we should be able to see how that works even in that case. And it's very simple. In that case, the bulk geometry is ADS in flat slicing. So A tilde, which is the warp factor, is exponential function of the radial coordinate. So it's e to the L. And therefore, its derivative divided by itself is just a constant. And that means once this is a constant, it is consistent to set the right-hand side of all these equations to zero and solve all the sigmas algebraically. And what the solution is if you look at sigma zero, is given by the potential minus V star divided by D. Sigma one is again given by minus V star. Sigma two, if you solve this quadratic equation, is given by minus one over delta plus minus, where delta is the usual dimension of the dual operator. So we cover the usual story that in this flat slicing, we should have conformal invariance where all the beta functions are vanishing. And we also see that the theory knows that the scalar fields need to be above the BF bound, in a sense that if they are not, then delta is complex, and we get some complex Wilsonian action, which is not consistent with unitarity.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Just a question. It seems to me that the level, you only work with the scalar fields. Let's consider ADS in global coordinates. It has a metric, you can write its metric in the same way that you write, but with a cinch instead of a sine.
This is ADS in DS slicing, it is cinch.
Yes.
Yes.
ADS.
ADS, yes, ADS in DS slicing. So
and
it's
the metric,
ADS.
And the metric you wrote is just an analytic continuation of that.
Yes.
Omega
correct.
Phi.
One can consider that also just by itself, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Simply, the level that you work with the scalar field, this will follow just a simple analytic continuation of the ADS case.
But the potential is very different. So the analytic continuation does not work well on the bulk potential. To get a De Sitter minimum, we actually need a bulk potential which has a positive minimum. And I think through the our previous ways of constructing just De Sitter space in a physical way, it involves more than just analytical continuation.
Talking about this scalar field analysis, this is nothing.
One can take the ADS case, and in the ADS DS slicing, one can completely use the same set of equations, and these two statements are still true. So
I'm not objecting. I'm saying that they are not. Let's say, is it a real test?
It's a yeah.
Maybe put in other words, once you would include the metric, why would the effective action be local?
Are you asking at the ADS case?
No.
Are you asking that the locality here is basically the locality of the bulk action can be thought of in a in a slightly technical way as coming from a Schrodinger evolution of the wave function in the bulk spacetime. So remember the psi uv I defined? It satisfies a radial Schrodinger equation when you evolve it in the radial direction. And since from that equation, you can sort of derive that it is local.
The level of scalar field, of course.
Sorry?
We can discuss this again
sure.
Later, but what about gravity?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay.
let's discuss the question later. So back to what I was saying, this set of equations makes sense for ADS flat slicing, and they have a very simple conformal scale invariant fixed point solution. However, when we have a de Sitter slicing, this is no longer a constant, therefore it's not consistent to set all of the beta functions to zero. So we have some non-trivial running for the multi-trace slice. Let me just make some comments about this set of equations. They provide a set of constraints for candidate dual theories in the sense that if, for example, someone hands you a theory which they claim to be dual to the de Sitter space, you can actually, if you're powerful enough, you can compute the beta functions and find whether that's true or not. So that's a very definitive criterion, at least in a large n limit. And it also helps us construct specific examples which may satisfy this set of constraints. And also for our previous brain construction, it may help us understand why it, to see how it satisfies the constraint. It also, in some sense, we can turn it around and say we find a field theory that might be dual to de Sitter, but we don't know what the de Sitter box spacetime is. We only know the field theory. Now what we can do is to read off the box potential from all the beta functions, which is also very useful. Because if we have all the beta functions, we can read off the potential value of the potential and all its derivatives through this infinite set of beta functions. And that allows us to reconstruct the potential, at least locally near the extrema. And if it has good analytic property, perhaps to a larger region. So in this sense, we can use it both ways. Let me just point out a few caveats and generalizations. We have only considered the zero modes on the d-dimensional slice. So it's possible to generalize to higher non-zero mode, the KK modes. And we can include multiple scalar fields in the discussion. We can consider, in addition to scalars, we can consider spinners and vectors. And in particular, we can consider the metric, which is dual to the stress tensor. And we basically get the same qualitative result when we have made these generalizations. There is one thing about counterterms I want to remark on, which is in the ADS case, we usually need to include counterterms into the discussion, and it can be done. But it turns out it's absent in a DSDS case through a symmetry. Let me explain what that is. Let's think about the static patch of the de Sitter space foliated by lower dimensional de Sitter. Let's take the boundary. Let's take the cutoff to be the central slice for both theories. If we include a counterterm, for example, for the left-hand side of the theory, we have to include minus the counterterm for the right-hand side of the theory, because the entire partition function is just the integral of everything inside, with no special insertion on the central slice. In other words, the central slice by itself in the bulk is a smooth region. So whatever you put in the path integral should be, whatever you put in to the left-hand side of the path integral should also you should also get rid of it from the right-hand side. And that means if we introduce any non-zero counterterm, it will break the symmetry between left and right. If you believe that the counterterm should preserve this Z2 symmetry, then the counterterm should be zero. And that actually leads to a result with a statement about the trace of the stress tensor of the dual field theory, which says it's actually zero. This is different from the ADS case, for example. In the ADS case, we have, this is an ADS slash de Sitter slicing, and the trace of the stress tensor is basically given by some sort of central charge times the curvature of the de Sitter space. So it's non-zero there. However, here it is zero, and it's some, in some sense it's not too surprising because ultimately we want to consistently couple it to gravity. And for that to happen, we might expect that T should be zero. This is particularly clear if we think about D equals 2, where this is just Liouville theory. But I think this is something we should that is also something that we can use for constructing possible dual theories. By the way, I just mentioned that it also agrees with our previous calculation using another method for this case. I'm already out of time, so I just briefly mention that we can also encode the meta stability of the pseudo space into the calculation. It basically involves Coleman Deluchin instanton contribution to this path integral, and it does it in a way that it gives a slightly complex contribution to psi uv and also to the effective action. So we have currently computed our basically w, this piece, which is perturbative in 1 over n. In fact, we only calculated a leading term in that 1 over n expansion. We could have computed more, but these instanton corrections contribute exponentially small terms, but they are complex. That means the theory by itself is not completely unitary. It is true for a long, it is probably approximately so for a very long time, but eventually it decays, and we need more degrees of freedom from the force, from the true vacuum to actually formulate a complete theory. So let me conclude and point out the future directions. We have basically identified necessary and perhaps also sufficient at large n conditions for the dual theory of the static patch. Basically, the single trace terms have zero beta function, and multi-trace couplings have iterative structure. We would like to apply this to previous brain constructions, but maybe it's too complicated. So something which we have been thinking right now is we can actually come up with a simpler example, which is, since our derivation holds basically for each scalar field which is stabilized in a bulk, stabilized meaning that V prime is zero, so we don't actually need to do it for all the fields in the bulk. So we can start with a partially stabilized example, which comes from, for example, by adding 9 grains to a D3 system. And we can study this because from the field theory side, it's quite simple and possibly tractable, and we can compare both sides. So that's something we have been doing with Eva and Matt at Stanford. And we also want to think about the coupling to dynamical gravity eventually. I haven't talked about that because I've been basically talking about a matter sector of the dual theory. Eventually, we have to include dynamical gravity as well. Perhaps in D equals 2, we have a simplified control in terms of Liouville gravity, but it remains to be worked out. So that's all I'm planning to say. Thank you very much.
So back on a couple slides on this stuff here, you have, forward one. Right. So I was very confused at the kind of the bottom 2 points. It looks like you're holding the metric in the middle fixed. Is that what you're doing?
Yes, because I haven't included dynamical gravity yet. So the dynamical gravity is actually in lower dimension, in the d-dimensional dynamical gravity that is eventually coupled to this matter sector, is going to involve fluctuations of the metric there.
Right.
So yeah, that's exactly the last comment I had, which is, eventually, we have to include that. So right now, the criterion we have proposed is kind of a two-step process. If you want to, this is a kind of procedure in this framework of if we want to build a dual theory for the pseudo-static patch. We first find a matter sector, meaning some quantum field theory. which has the RG structure that I talked about. So single trace, zero beta function, multi-trace, et cetera, et cetera. Then, and the second step, which I agree is, which I think is also very important, is to couple that to gravity. And I had some comments about how that may be within control in D equals 2. Ultimately, maybe one has to think about how to either do that in D equals 2 or if we want to do it in higher dimensions, do using DSDS correspondence in an iterative way and getting from higher dimension all the way down to D equals 2. So that's going to be the perhaps difficult part. And yeah, I didn't talk about that in detail, but I think it is certainly important to realize that's eventually what we have to do.
Well, I mean, I'm just not sure. I mean, this is, well, just to state the obvious, right? I mean, the usual reason one says, you know, ADS-CFT makes sense is gravity decouples. Things will fall off, that anything massive will bounce off, and,
right.
Which definitely does not look to be the case here. So if I toss anything,
that's exactly,
it'll ripple that. And,
right, that's exactly
and
the
I,
difference.
I,
that's exactly the difference between ADS-CFT, which has a non-gravitational dual, and DSDS, which has a gravitational dual.
Right, but then you start talking about terms of things which I would normally only understand if the metric is fixed, which I'm only going to be able to do if gravity decouples in that fashion in some way or another. So.
Maybe you're asking how well defined it is to separate a theory coupled to gravity into a non-gravitational system and its coupling to gravity. Is that what you are trying to ask?
Well, it's related. I mean, if you want to use the last two things in things that are more or less the usual way, maybe you have a new construction in mind.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe by back reaction on the metric, I actually mean bulk metric, not a lower dimensional metric. So this is completely by bulk reaction to the metric. I mean the bulk metric. So I'm allowing bulk metric fluctuations, just treating it as another field in a bulk. So that's completely at leading order in large N. This is completely okay. This is just the way, this is the same, what we did explicitly in our paper is to consider a mini superspace approach where we include the diagonal fluctuation of the metric into the consideration. But one can also consider other mode of the metric fluctuation. It is not difficult.
Well, presumably the diagonal, if you're going to treat it perturbative with SMU pure gauge anyway, so that will.
It is.
That will tell you anything.
But the off diagonal modes are just, in the transverse traceless gauge, they're just behave like scalar fields.
Yeah, but the point is in general, it's not going to be just perturbative. Well,
sorry, I think maybe you're concerned about how to even think about loops of gravitons.
No, even just classically.
Just classically, I think we can just do the path integral, do the bulk path integral that I wrote down at a semi classical level. So at leading order in large N, we can just plug in solutions of the classical equations of motion. That's going to be the procedure.
The point is a generic thing will come in and hit your thing that you're trying to hold fixed and disturb it.
Oh. I think okay. I'm
not
going,
saying anything deeper on quantum, right?
I should have explained this much more carefully. This metric, meaning the metric fluctuation on the intermediate slice, I'm allowing arbitrary fluctuations of that. Meaning that I'm allowing fluctuations in the DSDS in the higher dimension of the Sitter space, but I'm holding fixed the central slice, the metric fluctuation on the central slice. That's indeed what I'm doing. That's the place where the d-dimensional theory lives, and eventually we need to consider allowing those metric fluctuation. That's lower dimensional gravity. But I've included higher dimensional gravity in the sense that I've considered fluctuations of or back reaction on the d plus one dimensional metric.
Okay,
is that clear?
I think we're going around in circles over here.
I have a related question. It's
probably. Problem.
if you want to handle the bulk gravity more than just perturbatively, if you want
yes.
to go into the non-perturbative regime,
yes.
then there's a, at least to me, there's a confusion. What corresponds to that static patch? I mean, now you just have some general curves, some general curved space-time that's before a deformation of De Sitter, but it can be a large deformation of De Sitter. In the De Sitter, you singled out one particular geodesic, and you said basically its causal past
yeah.
and its causal
right,
future
right.
is what. But now, are we singling out some particular geodesic? Or what singles out that particular lower dimensional De Sitter, you know, De Sitter like the deformation of that central line?
I think this
how
is
how do you locate it? That's really the question.
I think it's related to
that,
the question about.
Well, it's related.
It's related.
I think it's related to a previous question in the sense that right now, basically considering dynamical gravity, we are basically fixing the metric on the central
no.
slice fix. So therefore, the geodesic is fixed. And we are fluctuating in this metric. So let me just go back to the formula here. In this metric, we are basically allowing fluctuation of the bulk metric subject to the boundary condition that on the UV slice I have something definite. So in that sense I'm fluctuating the bulk metric.
And you don't intend to go more to a more general.
I thought
your intention was to allow the metric to fluctuate on the central slice.
Eventually, that's going to be the part where we have to include dynamical gravity. So,
yeah, so my question was about that stage. Of
yeah,
work.
We. I don't.
There's some conceptual confusion, at least in my mind.
I think I agree. We don't know. We don't have much to say about that part yet. All we are saying is before. Before coupling to gravity, the theory should have specific properties. It is in some sense similar to DSCFT. The analogous statement is we have a Euclidean theory which is also on the fluctuating background, and but before we allow the metric to fluctuate, it is a CFT. There are the properties that the beta function satisfied is zero.
But I think there's a difference in that case. I don't know much about that case, but in that case, given, say, a classical solution, you can sort of go to future infinity and pick out, you know, sort of where this CFT is living, or this generalized CFT is living, because it's some sort of well-defined boundary, presumably, some sort of conformal boundary to the bulk space. But here it's not clear where this boundary, it's not a real boundary, right? It's just some surface that you somehow located arbitrarily but subject to symmetry within De Sitter. But once you go away from the highly symmetric metric, it's not, that's my confusion, it's not clear where this surface is anymore. It's not at infinity anymore.
I was just merely pointing out that if you really think about the DSCFT case, it really has the same problem. So
but does it? That's what I don't understand. Why does it have the same problem?
If you calculate, for example, a bulk correlation function in De Sitter, in terms of the field theory defined on the future boundary, you have to integrate over the metric on the future boundary. So
no, but that's the statement that there's a dynamical metric in your dual theory. That's
yes, in
saying,
that case, yes.
Which I didn't know, but that's what you're saying.
Yes.
But that's not the same thing that the dual theory is not well-defined. Here it looks as if the dual theory is not even well-defined. It's less well-defined than it would be in that situation. Because it doesn't know where it's living. It may have a dynamic metric.
I would say in both cases, they're living on a metric, on a back. They're living, in both cases, they're living on a manifold with a fluctuating metric.
But in one case, you sort of know how to extract that manifold.
In fact,
from the bulk,
this is,
in the other case, you don't.
Perhaps we can discuss it offhand. But I think the short thing I want to say is, even in the ADS CFT case, the field theory doesn't really live on the boundary. It lives everywhere in the sense that the concrete statement is the quantum gravity in the bulk is due to some CFT living on some low dimensional manifold. We usually identify that manifold with the boundary of the ADS space, but it's just for a purpose of simplification. There's not really a need to do this identification. We can just abstractly talk about the field theory defined on some manifold. And that has a dual description in terms of a bulk geometry. And they don't have to be related. So in that sense, I don't really see the problem that you're pointing out.
Okay,
do you understand what I'm saying?
No.
He's imagining that you could still describe the field theory on this effect, essentially fixed thing, despite the fact the real thing is fluctuating.
Yes. You can abstractly think about some field theory.
You can certainly say there's an abstract manifold, but how would you relate it to the bulk? There has to be some rule that relates that abstract manifold to the bulk.
I think that's an important question that I don't really have a concrete answer for. Yeah, I totally agree that we don't have a full dictionary once the field theory is coupled to gravity, and I think that's a very important question to understand if we want to understand the city space.
Okay, let's thank our speakers.